Hello, and welcome to the Legal Marketing 2.0 podcast. I'm your host, Guy Alvarez, and today we'll be speaking with Despina Carson. Despina is the Director of Business Development and Communications at Jones Day. And today, Despina is going to talk about how she has seen the legal marketer's role and the CMO's role evolve over the last 16 years at law firms. In addition to that, Despina is going to be talking about her new book, Last Night Supron, and the fabulous charity that she's involved with. Welcome, Despina.
Thank you, Guy. Great to be with you. Thank you very much.
Great to have you here. So, Despina, I have known you for quite a long time. We go back to the days of ALM and PLI, and I have been in touch with you throughout your career. What I wanted to talk about today is two things that I think our listeners will be really interested in. First, I want to get your impression how you think the world of legal marketing has evolved since you got involved with it, and get a little bit of insight of, you know, where we've been, where we are, and we might be going. And then I want to talk about your new book, or recently published book, Last Night's Supron. And I think our listeners will be really interested to learn what the book's all about, the charity that you're involved in, and how the book came about. But let's start at the beginning and tell us a little bit about how did you get into legal marketing?
I got into legal marketing, I think, accidentally, which to some extent seems to be the way a lot of us have gotten into it. But I was working as the vice president of business development for a company that was selling services to law firms. And as a result of that, found my way with an opportunity to move into legal marketing. So it was having an opportunity to be on the other side of the process from the service provider side. So that's essentially how I got into it.
It seems like a lot of us get into it that way.
That's true.
So how long ago was that you got into legal marketing? How long have you been in this space?
Right. It's been about a good 16 years.
What do you think have been the biggest change from when you started in legal marketing to today?
Well, I think there are probably lots of changes, frankly. I think the profession has evolved pretty substantially, but I can think of about five areas that I think have changed the most. I think that, first of all, the CMO role has become much more technical. CMOs are expected to understand technology tools, client extranets, CRM and ERM systems, marketing databases, and all of the various tools available to support the needs of the firms, of their firms working with their clients, as well as the tools that are available to support their internal BD functions. So I think just the whole area of technology and needing to be much more conversant with the technology tools is a pretty significant change.
And you were always pretty well versed in technology, so.
Yes, actually I was. I mean, I started way back in the day in e-discovery and litigation support, so I've always been comfortable with technology, and it's something I think I gravitate towards, so that's been exciting.
How else have you seen legal marketing evolve?
Yes, I think that certainly in, I would say, the last 5 or so years, I think that firms are much more focused on business development than ever before. In the early days of law firm marketing, I think it was all about just that, marketing. And over the last several years, I think the shift has been more towards business development and client development and those one-to-one interactions to cultivate relationships in business, and a little bit less so on the broader general marketing approaches.
From my evolution in this space, I think when I got started, you know, the word business development, or God forbid sales, was something that lawyers really didn't want to hear about. They didn't believe it in it. You know, it was, being a lawyer was a profession, but that has certainly changed, as you said. And so what kind of, you know, how do you think that change has affected law firms? How does that change affect the role of the CMO overall? How does that change affect the relationship with the leadership at a firm, with someone in charge of business development and marketing?
I think it's changed the way that lawyers understand they need to develop relationships. And I think that they understand the days are gone that you can simply have a client for life because there is so much more competition than ever before. So I think that lawyers understand that they need to have business development skills. They naturally look toward and lean on the business development and marketing teams to provide them with those skills and resources. So whether it's helping them with training or developing business development plans or coaching programs and so forth, I think that lawyers recognize that they need those tools and resources and that level of support. And I think it's really the way that CMOs and their teams have evolved to be able to provide those services to the lawyers.
And do you find that lawyers today are much more open to that type of training and, in a sense, education that they were in the past?
I think so. I think most lawyers do recognize it. I think there might be some generational issues and differences of philosophy, but I think that for the most part, they do recognize that they need to be more business development savvy. I don't think that everyone's yet comfortable with the quote-unquote sales term, but I think business development is something that they recognize they need.
And in terms of the marketing department as a whole, as you mentioned, there's been a shift from strictly a focus on marketing towards a shift more focused on business development, client development, and cultivating relationships. So for those listeners that are either working at law firms or considering working at law firms within the marketing business development focus, you know, what would you say are the really important skills that they need or they need to acquire in order to succeed in this arena?
I think that because the lawyers have recognized the need to become more sophisticated in their business development efforts, they then have expectations of the BD staff that they're working with. And I think that they are looking for much more proactivity from the business development teams and less reaction or reactivity. There will always be the need to be reactive to lawyer requests, but I think that they're really looking to us to offer proactive suggestions, to identify business development opportunities, to help develop target client lists, to participate in client feedback programs, or to give them guidance on conducting client feedback with their clients. And so I think that there's a level of expectation that the lawyers have that the BD staff is much more sophisticated in business development.
Absolutely.
Than before.
And what role does data play in that sophistication? You know, really getting to understand the client, getting to understand what the client needs or what the client is looking for. I've spoken to a lot of in-house counsel and business owners, and the thing I keep hearing is they want a law firm that understands their business. They want a law firm that has done the type of work that they need to be done, the types of issues that they're facing. But they also want a law firm that is going to provide added value. What are your thoughts about that?
I think that's absolutely correct. I think the expectations of clients has also increased over the years, certainly over the last several years. And I think that that has also led CMOs to build out business development and marketing teams that also have more specialized roles in them. The generalist position is still an important one that exists, especially in large teams. But I think that specialty roles, including those that support practice areas, those roles that are focused on social media, that are focused on content marketing, events, data analytics, all of those I think are newish roles that have emerged and evolved over time. And they're really due to client demands and client expectations. Certainly pitch and proposal teams, centralized pitch and proposal teams that are very expert and focused on creating client-focused pitches that are super responsive to what the client's needs are. All of that has been driven by the expectations from the clients that their law firms provide them with greater value and really focus on their needs. So, you know, we've seen this even in the shift of law firm websites, where websites are now more content-focused. They're much more about talking about solutions that they've created and provided to their clients, with a little bit of less of an emphasis on them as a firm as far as size and geographic footprint and so forth. And I'm not suggesting that that's not important, but the shift has been more towards client centricity.
So you mentioned technology and how that's become much more important. You mentioned the client focus and really understanding where the client is coming from, the issues that they face, the knowledge within the industry or within the companies. As a CMO, how do you manage to stay on top of all of that? It seems like there's so much, and I know just by speaking to you and every time I see you how busy you are, but how do you manage to kind of stay above it all and sort of, you know, continue to learn and still manage to be effective at your job?
Well, it's a fun challenge. So it means that you're sort of always on, your ear is always to the ground, you're always reading, you're always participating in programs, whether they're webcasts or others, so that you're constantly staying on top of your game as far as whether it's changing technologies or changing expectations from the client perspective. So I think that's one area. And I think it also is fantastic when you have a great team of colleagues to work with, because, and I do have a great team, and I've been fortunate to have great teams over the course of my career. And those are people that you come to rely on and lean on, so that if someone is your social media person, for example, you're counting on them to keep you apprised of changes in social media that will have an impact on the firm or new approaches that the firm might want to adopt or what have you. So I think it's a combination of really just staying on top of your game and keeping your ear to the ground on developments, but also making sure that you have a strong team that you work very collaboratively with and that you really rely on.
So on top of all the great work you do in your role as CMO, somehow you manage, and I, you know, it just amazes me, somehow you manage to be very involved with a charity. I know that you're involved with the Greek Orthodox Church and you serve in one of the charities. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved with the charity and how that led to your new book that you published.
Sure, thank you. So yes, in my spare time, I am very involved. And so I am a member and a board member and a couple of different regional and local boards of a Greek Orthodox ladies philanthropic organization that is called Philoptohos, which the literal translation in Greek stands for Friends of the Poor. So this organization is one that does so many great things, both in New York and across the country, to serve the poor. And so a number of years ago, actually 11 years ago, we began serving food to those who are homeless and hungry on the streets of New York. And to date, we've served nearly 11,000 meals. And we actually started off 11 years ago serving soup, but it's completely evolved into something much, much bigger than soup. But when we started this, we would call it the soup run, just because we couldn't think of anything more creative than calling it the soup run, because we were serving soup. And so we still call it the soup run, even though we only serve soup, I would say, maybe once or twice a year, and we really serve hot meals. So that's how I got involved.
That's great. And so your new book, which is called Last Night Soup Run, tell us the story behind that. What does the title mean and how you got to put together the book?
So when we first started the soup run, I would send an email the next morning. And by the way, we go once a month to a particular location on the streets of New York. And we pick the last Thursday of the month, because typically by the end of the month, if those that we're serving are receiving any sort of government assistance, their money is definitely running out. So mm-hmm. we go on the last Thursday of the month. And so typically Friday morning, I would send a little email to the group of volunteers and our supporters, just explaining to them what we did on last night's soup run. And so I would send this email, and the subject line was always called last night's soup run so that everyone knew what it was about. And I would just give highlights of the evening, who we served, the experiences that we had, and just a little summary of the evening. And so over the years, and there are always really some compelling stories that get shared about those that we're serving. And we call them our guests, by the way. So we treat them with a lot of dignity and compassion. And so we talk about our guests. And so over the years, people have suggested to me that I write a book. And I sort of, you know, didn't really pay much attention to that suggestion. But then it struck me when we had hit our 10-year mark and we had served more than 10,000 meals. I thought, well, maybe this is a good time to put a book together. So that's when I decided it was time to publish a book sharing many of the stories from the soup run experience. And I thought, well, the most appropriate title of the book should be Last Night's Soup Run.
I love it. I love it. So, I mean, it's amazing. Like, how did you find the time on top of everything else to put a book together? It's just, it's incredible. Would you mind sharing maybe one of those stories with our audience? I would love that. I know I attended the your book launch party, and I know you shared a couple of them that I really thought were amazing. But if you could share one of them, that would be fabulous.
So we, as I mentioned, we really do treat our guests with compassion and kindness, and we offer them, I guess, what I would call a judgment-free ear to listen to them and to talk to them. We interact with them very personally. We know their names, many of them. We know many of their stories. They joke with us. They're very appreciative. It's quite a lovely experience. And so over the years, we have gotten to know so many of them. And I'm not sure whether it's good or bad when we see our guests on a regular basis. On the one hand, we're happy to see them from one month to the next because, you know, we're happy that they're still somewhat safe and we have a little opportunity to take care of them. On the other hand, we wish that we weren't seeing them consistently every month. But, sure. You know, one of our recurring takeaways is that phrase, "There but for the grace of God go I." And by that, we mean that the people that we meet are in so many respects no different from you or I. They're educated. They have families. They had homes. They had jobs. In many respects, they had the same opportunities that we have all had, but through bad circumstances, bad judgments, just things that went awry, they have now found themselves in really awful situations. But, you know, I remember meeting a gentleman and speaking with him for quite some time one night, and he was really hunched over, pushing a walker, but incredibly articulate. And we were having a fairly sophisticated conversation about the food that we were serving. And so I started asking him a little bit more about his story. And it turns out that he was a professional chef, educated at the Culinary Institute of America.
Wow.
And had worked for more than 20 years as a sous chef at various high-end restaurants in New York. And he had an accident, and while I don't know all of the details, but one thing led to another. There were medical situations, and the next thing you know, he can't work any longer. He's depleted all of his savings, and now he's homeless, and he does magic tricks in Central Park to just get by. And, you know, it chokes me up every time I think of this person or every time I tell this story, because that is really an example of that could be you, that could be me, that could be our family and friends. You know, someone who clearly was educated, had a great job, has a talent, and just through a series of really unfortunate circumstances, he finds himself in the position that he's in.
That is so true and so apropos what's going on in the world today and in our country. Do you find in when you go on your soup runs lately, do you find that there's more homeless now in New York City than they were before? I mean, it seems to me, I just, by walking around the streets, I see the sort of an upsurge in homelessness over the last year, 2 years. Do you find that as well?
Yes. Well, there definitely is an uptick in homelessness. And just in general, like the New York City Coalition for the Homeless says that we now have the highest rates of homelessness since the Depression. There are people who choose to live on the streets because the shelters are in many cases not at all where you want to be, but nonetheless, there are 130,000 homeless individuals that sleep in New York City shelters on any given night, and more than 45,000 of those 130,000 are children. I mean, there are families that are homeless and children who are growing up in homeless shelters. There are 40,000 veterans that are homeless every night across the country. I mean, these to me are just staggering statistics. And especially in New York, where the cost of housing and the conditions of affordable housing are really some of the reasons that there's such an increase in homelessness. And yes, I do think there's an uptick. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think with gentrification and with progress and so forth, comes also situations where you're pushing people out of some of the few places that they can afford. So yeah, there is definitely an uptick.
So Desmond, what can people do if they want to get involved in your organization? How can they help?
Well, thank you for asking. So what I did was I formed a nonprofit, and the name of my nonprofit is called Philoxenia, which is also a Greek word. And it stands for, again, the literal translation is taking care of strangers. And it's about the general sense of offering hospitality to strangers and taking care of them. And so I thought that word was incredibly apropos of what we do on the soup run. And so all of the profits from the sale of my book, as well as any donations, go to Philoxenia. And we use that money to, essentially, the purpose and the mission of the organization is to provide inspiration, funding, and programming to those who feed and care for persons who are hungry or homeless. So we have given out money to other organizations that have small homeless outreach programs or want to do something to support the hungry and homeless and don't have the funding themselves. So certainly purchasing my book, which is available on Amazon, going to the Philoxenia website and making a donation and just generally being in touch, I'd be happy to share this story with anyone who's interested.
That's great. So we will put a link to your book on Amazon on the show notes, and we will also include a link to the Philoxenia website so that anyone that wants to get involved or wants to make a donation, they can do that through those two resources.
And all can right, I just so, offer one other suggestion?
Absolutely, yes.
Since the book launch, a number of legal marketers who were in attendance at the book launch have come on the soup run over the last several months, and they've just found it to be an amazing experience. And so certainly anyone who listens to this and is interested in joining, they should get in touch with me and I'll let them know when we're going and where to meet. But the other thing, as legal marketers, that I think is something to keep in mind, we accept donations of items, whether it's t-shirts or socks or what have you. And we have had donations of items that were branded items that organizations no longer needed because they were rebranding. So for example, we had an organization donate flashlights, these nice little portable flashlights that had the old branding on them. Or we've had canvas tote bags with old branding on them. So one thing to think about as for all of us in legal marketing, when you think about a rebranding initiative, and then what do you do with all of those items that you no longer need, there is virtually no possible item that couldn't and wouldn't be used by someone who is living on the streets. So I would certainly invite all of the listeners to consider making donations of in kind of any items like that that they might have.
Excellent. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Espina. I've taken a lot of your time. It's been great to have you on the show and talk to you both about your remarkable career as well as this fabulous charity and what you're doing with it. Is there anything else that you'd like to add or anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
No, I think the last thing that I would add, which is oftentimes when people ask what they can do aside from the things that I just mentioned, there's a quote from Mother Teresa that says, if you can't feed 100 people, then just feed one. And I think that that resonates with me particularly because so many times you walk past a homeless person on the street and you may think, well, I'm not sure what I could do to help them out. But if you can take a meal to them, if you're on your way to lunch or dinner and you simply buy an extra meal at the restaurant and you go back and you deliver it to them, or if you have leftovers from the meal, I mean, every time I go to a restaurant and I have leftovers, I take them with me. And within a couple of blocks of leaving the restaurant, I find someone to give them to. So I think keeping in mind, if you can't feed 100 people and you can just feed one, then you've done something great.
Love it. Thank you so much for your time, Espina. Really appreciate it. And thank you for being on our show.
Thank you so much, Guy. I really appreciate it too. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you want to make sure that you don't miss another episode, please go to our website, goodtobesocial.com/podcast, and subscribe. Thank you again, and hope you find today's episode interesting.